Dr. Lewis Myers here with Healthcare Today. It's great to be back after being away for 2 weeks, combination of work and vacation. We're going to be talking about healthcare affordability today. Everyone knows that healthcare in America is expensive, and especially so here in Vermont. Healthcare affordability usually ranks as one of people's biggest concerns. We're going to explore healthcare costs in Vermont today with an interesting panel of guests. In our first half hour, we will hear from three young medical students who have been participating in an online symposium this summer run by the Northern New England Health Policy Internship Program, coordinated by Vermont physician Dr. Marvin Malik. In the second half hour, we have Mike Fisher, who is a longtime Vermont legislator and for the past several years has been the healthcare advocate for Vermont Legal Aid. So I want to welcome all of our guests. We're going to start with our students, and I'm going to ask you briefly to introduce yourselves, but also to thank you for being here. I know that I believe you're all rising second-year students, having completed the first year, but in medical school, generally, the first summer after first year is the only free time that students have in their four-year program. So to use that time to continue your education this way is really admirable, and we thank you. So let me go to Shivani, Dr. Shivani Hi. Jain, and welcome. Is that you?
Hi, thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Myers.
Now, I do have your bio. I'm just going to read it briefly because it's certainly interesting. You are a rising second-year medical student at LSU in New Orleans. You actually completed master's and doctoral work focused on public health, epidemiology, and cancer biostatistics. Although you're originally from Louisiana and are in school there, you've also lived abroad in South America, in Africa, and in India, and have been looking at their healthcare systems. I also want to mention my uncle was a professor at LSU for 30 years. It's a great institution. It's nice to have an LSU Tiger with us. So welcome.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And we have Subbaran here. Are you there?
Hi, yes, it's Imran. Thank you so much for having me.
And where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Long Island, New York. I'm a student at Stony Brook School of Medicine.
Terrific. And you're also starting your second year this fall, this summer?
Yes.
Okay. And is there a Scotty on the line?
Hi, this is Shad.
Shad, okay.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you, Dr. Myers.
Yes, and where are you calling from?
I'm calling from New Jersey.
And what medical school are you associated with?
I'm a rising second year at Rutgers New Jersey Medical School in Newark, New Jersey.
Well, it's terrific, and I want to thank you all for being here. Tell me a little bit, I guess I'll start with Dr. Subbaran. Dr. Chivani, tell me a little bit about the program and some of the things you've learned this summer.
Yes, I'm so excited to do that. This has been a really transformative experience. You know, I was passionate, wanted to learn a lot more about health policy from all different angles and from political experts across the spectrum during this internship, and to learn about how to advocate for a more just, accessible, and high-quality system than we have currently. And I feel like we went full in, deep dive in all the angles, learning about everything from pharma to hospital systems, provider relations, as well as, you know, the national picture, the state picture, even the local level grassroots organizing. They did an amazing job. The preceptors, the guest speakers they brought in, all the other interns, and the community we built up over the summer, I think we're going to continue to build it up.
Yeah, I'm looking at the list of people you got to meet online. Dr. Malik looks like did a great job of bringing in some real policymakers and people who are actually working in the field. And I think what you say about forming a network now of young people who are devoted to working and improving the system is encouraging. Dr. Subbaran, tell me about what motivated you to give up vacation time to learn about health policy?
Yeah, as someone who's had experiences in healthcare before pursuing a medical degree, I've seen firsthand that our healthcare system really fails so many of our patients just based on their ability to afford care. And having seen that up close, I feel really passionately that we need to establish a better system. So this internship seemed like a really perfect way to educate myself, both on the policy implications, but also on how to advocate for this legislation, for these changes that I feel will really improve outcomes for my future patients.
Can you tell me one basic concept that may have been new to you that you had not encountered?
I actually had never heard of PBMs before. That was something completely new to me.
Can you explain briefly what those are?
Sure, yeah. They're pharmacy benefit organizations or management organizations. And basically they work as sort of a third party between pharmaceutical manufacturers, insurance companies, and patients. And they're just sort of yet another example of administrative burden on our entire system that serves to drive up costs and eventually really leads to bad outcomes for our patients in the end.
And I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing again, but Scotty, can you again tell me your name so I can write it down?
No problem. It's Shad.
S-H-A-D. Okay, Shad. It sounds like learning about healthcare systems in other countries was a major part of the internship as well as, of course, looking at the United States. What insights did you gain from learning about healthcare in other countries?
You know, I think learning about other countries' healthcare systems is essential to trying to decide how can we reform healthcare in the United States today. We learned about various different countries with various different healthcare models from England, Germany, Switzerland, Taiwan. And I think that there are a lot of great things that come from other countries' healthcare systems. The United States in general has done a great job of taking pieces from our international context and bringing it into the United States to improve the lives of Americans. And I think healthcare is just another way we can do that. And so we should really take lessons from these other countries of how they're able to make sure every single citizen gets healthcare coverage and has equal access to healthcare. And I think we can really use those lessons to inform our reform for healthcare in the United States.
Dr. Shivani, you actually, it sounds like you have lived and worked in other countries as you've gone through and gotten master's and doctorate degrees. What has been your experience in some of those countries, like on-the-ground experiences in terms of their healthcare systems?
Certainly. You know, I spent a lot of time living in the UK, for one thing, and I was very pleasantly surprised at how easy it was when I got sick with avian flu there as a student and someone working there, at how streamlined the system was in testing in terms of recovery, getting the diagnosis, getting the medication I needed, and follow-up care, even having a physician coming to my home, which is such a contrast to how COVID has been handled, for example, recently here. But, you know, it depends on the country, right, because they're dealing with the history and infrastructure they have in terms of what I saw in Ecuador with indigenous medicine in India, both of rural and national urban centers. So I think it will vary greatly in terms of what they have to deal with and also what the population is used to. What I saw all across the board was there was definitely a lot of attention paid to how well money was being spent, the value add in healthcare. People were a lot more bootstrapped for finances, so had to make really strategic decisions and didn't want to waste any healthcare spending wherever they could, which I feel like is such a contrast to what happens in the U.S. system that I've seen and practiced in or worked in.
One of the unfortunate issues, though, in some of the countries you've mentioned, and particularly as we see Venezuela and Ecuador to some degree, and some of the African countries where there is political dysfunction and upheaval, that the healthcare system always seems to take a hit. Would you agree?
That can be true.
Yeah.
That would definitely be true in some cases.
Well, can you tell us about Cuba? We hear a lot about the Cuban medical system, that the in terms of the primary care system, and in terms of the fact that they export physicians to countries where they're needed, such as Brazil and other places, Venezuela. What can you tell us? What do you know about the Cuban system?
Actually, I can tell you a little bit, but I also
wait. I'm sorry. Someone wanted to say yes.
go for it, Simran.
Oh, yeah. I was going to jump in here because actually part of our internship is generating student projects, and I completed mine with another team member on the Cuban healthcare system. And what really stuck out to me is their approach to integrating public health and medicine together. So as you mentioned, because they have a very low GDP, there's a lot of incentive to keep costs low, and that leads to a lot of investment in preventive care. So they have a model that set up in a very coordinated fashion. There's individual physicians who live in each rural town and provide first-line care to their constituents. And then as care becomes more intense or more intense care is required, patients can be sent up to higher levels of more robust care if they so need. It's nationalized, and so every citizen has coverage. And it's really fascinating. I was watching a video about it, and a Cuban citizen was explaining how in the United States, what does a kidney transplant cost? People are afraid to, many people forego a transplant that they really need because they can't afford it. But in Cuba, any citizen who needs it can have access to that kind of service.
So, well, that's fascinating. Let me ask the other two students, what were your projects on this summer? Shad, I'll ask you first.
Yeah, so my project, we have to complete two projects regarding our healthcare systems and international healthcare systems. And so my international project that I'm still currently working on is around the international context of homelessness and how we take care of patients experiencing homelessness here in the United States compared to how other countries take care of that population. And it's really interesting because I think that the homeless population in general is one of the most disenfranchised in the United States today. And I think we currently do a very poor job of making sure that homeless patients know the resources that are available to them, know that they are eligible for Medicaid. And we were speaking to people in primary care in Vermont as well, and they were talking about how homeless patients in their clinic have difficulty knowing that they are eligible for Medicaid and have difficulty signing up for Medicaid. And that's definitely an issue that happens all around the country. And I think we need to do a better job with that.
I think where we see many of the homeless is in the emergency department, which ends up providing some form of primary care, but certainly not as comprehensive as if people were seeing their own primary care provider. So let me ask each of you two, just stepping back from the policy issues, you've each, I believe, finished first year medical school, and all three of those are really great medical schools. You went through first year medical school during the year which was really defined by COVID in many ways. Now, I know first year is generally in the classroom with mostly academic type preclinical work, but how do you think it changed your education this year? What did it mean to you being there during COVID? Dr. Chivani, I'll start with you.
You know, yeah, I think our school adapted as well as they could, and certainly our class was very resilient and found ways to build those bonds and connections that are so critical in first year, despite having to be mostly virtual for a good portion. Our school did a great job of implementing mandatory testing and paying attention to the critical news locally to determine those intervals of testing, to making sure people had mandatory PPE that they were wearing, to restricting access to what wasn't essential, and really expanding our outreach. I helped run a COVID clinic and testing, actually, at my school, which was amazing, working across all sectors, all the schools, to really educate our local population about how important it is to get tested and vaccinated when the time came. And so I just think our school did the best they could with the resources and really continued to prompt us to think mindfully about our whole community.
We know, of course, that New Orleans was hit very, very hard by COVID.
Exactly.
Yeah. So second year hopefully will be something approximating normal. Does it change your view at all of this profession that you've chosen? In terms of what you will be facing it now and in the future?
I certainly think it made me more of an advocate for single payer. I really think, you know, it's making me more want to go into health policy along with the rest of my career and make sure people have the access they need to these life-saving medications, vaccines, and education, preventative services, so we don't end up with another situation like what happened to the U.S. with the pandemic. And it really just, inspires me, all the sacrifices I saw.
Subharan, how about you? What was your first year like, and how does it look going forward?
Yeah, I think I would echo the same sentiments as Shivani. I think that my institution did a fairly reasonable job adapting to online schooling. Personally, I'm not somebody who thrives over Zoom. I think I really missed out on the human contact and getting to know my classmates, et cetera. But yeah, when I think about I think it's worth it when I think about the fallout for everyone who suffered through this pandemic, especially, you know, particularly the marginalized populations who are always disproportionately affected for lots of reasons, including less comprehensive insurance coverage, which wouldn't be a problem under a single-payer system.
And Shad, how about you? What was first year like for you this year?
Yeah, I think we had a very similar response in our school. Our entire first year was virtual, but I think our students did a really, really good job in staying engaged within the school and within our community. A big thing at our school is making sure students are engaged with service projects and making sure that our community is well taken care of. And one thing that was really important this year because of the COVID-19 crisis was that a lot of people lost their health care. A lot of people weren't able to access the same services that they would normally be able to access. And our students did a lot of hard work trying to maintain service projects, but we need national reform in order to make sure this doesn't happen again. And that's what motivates me to make sure that single payer is something that goes through, and single payer is something that we advocate for.
Shivani, let me ask you this. You worked in the clinics in New Orleans. As we know, a sizable percentage of Americans still have not either been fully vaccinated or perhaps not vaccinated at all, even as we see the Delta variant now starting to sweep the country. What did you say to people who had vaccine hesitancy?
Don't think it's fair to point fingers and blame and shame. I think it's important to reach people where they're at, to understand where their mistrust or misinformation or hesitancy comes from, to build a relationship, to use a lot of the same skills a good provider would, a good physician would, to understand what goes into the framework of mind, to really try to meet people where they're at and then point them to really helpful resources, and use some techniques we've even discussed during the internship about motivational interviewing, about how to really be effectively communicate, you know, to get our message across. And actually, I do vaccine research, so I could use, like, real-life, data that I've worked on to explain in context of how important it is, especially with the new Delta variant.
What kind of research have you been doing?
I've been looking at understanding what makes the worst outcomes in the ICU happen from an immunological perspective, especially for minority populations. Very nitty-gritty molecular science.
Any major findings you want to share pre-publication?
I can't share everything at the moment, but it is exciting what we're seeing with Delta, and I will say it's no surprise that people who are naturally infected are not going to be in a good situation. I don't think that's okay to say, because that's coming out across the nation. For our local population, we're seeing that. And, a lot of the theories around coagulation, clotting, and the predetermined sort of like comorbidities that go into making the worst outcomes are holding true in our data set. Yep.
Are we doing enough for the rest of the world? I know there was an emphasis, obviously, this past year on getting Americans vaccinated. But we look at the very, very low rates of vaccines available to the rest of the world. Are we doing enough?
I actually work for an organization called Justice is Global, and essentially the entire point of this organization is to make sure that we get vaccine access across the world. And right now, we're doing a poor job of vaccinating the global south. The United States proposed, or at least had support for the TRIPS waiver, which is a waiver by the World Trade Organization that allows for the vaccine, essentially its recipe, to be shared with other manufacturers. But we don't have the technology, or at least other manufacturers around the world don't have the technology to build those vaccines. And so I think we need to do a better job with sharing both the technology and the recipe of building this vaccine, so that way we get everybody around the world vaccinated, because their vaccination affects our rates of COVID as well.
I think this virus, certainly even more than HIV, has emphasized the interconnectedness of our world with here and across the world, that we cannot, even though we have oceans that separate us from much of the rest of the world, that no one is safe until everyone is safe.
And that is exactly why we have to push for single payer, Dr. Myers.
Yeah. I'm going to finish with that in the last 2.5 minutes we have. Is that Subbaran? I'm not sure if that was you. But all of you have mentioned single payer. Could one person sort of sum up why we need single payer? What the argument you would make? Subbaran, I'll go with you.
Okay. Just that we should live in a country where we care about our neighbors, and where we don't have to worry about our sisters and our brothers and our parents, you know, not having the healthiest lives that they can, in many cases, honestly choosing death over, you know, treatment just simply because they can't afford it. And single payer is an efficient, cheaper, universal coverage system that will achieve that for our nation, something that we are totally capable of and totally, totally deserve.
Ashad, I'll ask you this. We live, obviously, in a rather polarized society right now where there are a lot of people who have great distrust of the federal government. What would you say to someone who has that kind of distrust, and that extends perhaps to a government-run single-payer plan?
You know, I think that's a fair concern, but at the same time, I would ask that person, how much do you trust a private insurance company? Because we're seeing, in terms of spending of private insurance companies versus, for example, a Medicare program, 2% of Medicare spending goes to administrative costs versus 13% goes into administrative costs for private insurance companies. A lot of the private insurance companies have responsibilities to shareholders, to their CEOs, to things that aren't necessarily related to providing care for the patients that they serve. And we need a better system that provides for patients that we serve. We need a better system that provides for the 41% of Americans who are deferring care because of costs. We need a better system.
And finally, I'll give the last word to Sivani. In the 1 minute we have left, you've worked and lived around the world. Is there one particular healthcare system we should be learning from?
I think the reality is we have to learn from everyone. And as you mentioned, we're all so interconnected globally that we can't afford not to. I would say overall, the UK system to me stood out as the best from my own lived experiences, and because I spent the most time in that particular area. And I think also, in a lot of ways, our demographic, our population maps over nicely. I think there's so much we can take in terms of the people's perspective and how much they safeguard their system.
I want to thank all three of these medical students for giving up their time this summer to continue to learn about our healthcare system. You're all going to make magnificent contributions, and I admire you, all three of you, and your colleagues in that program. Thank you so much. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Welcome back to Healthcare Today, second half of our hour looking at healthcare affordability in Vermont. And again, I want to thank those three medical students for sharing their time and experiences this summer. I'm going to bring in now Mike Fisher, who is the healthcare advocate for Vermont Legal Aid. And I don't have your full bio, but wondered if you could just tell our listeners your professional background, and we'll go from there.
Good afternoon. Happy to be with you. Spent a little time talking about healthcare. My name is Mike Fisher, and I have this this interesting position at the moment. I am the chief healthcare advocate. This is a position that's defined, a position in an office that's defined in state statute. And the state goes out to bid, and Vermont Legal Aid has the contract for this set of services. I want to say a little bit more about just what we do, but I'll stick with your question. I've been doing this for a number of years, yes. Before this, I did a stint in the legislature for 14 years, and during that time spent a number of years in leadership positions on both the Human Service and on the healthcare committees, particularly during the time period when we were working up to attempt to, well, to pass at what became Act 48, and also pass the bills that reorganized the insurance marketplace and set up Vermont Health Connect. So it was an exciting time. And just to round out my bio so you know where I come from, I also spent 27 years as a frontline direct service social worker in rural Addison County, working with teen families, teen parents, and their kids.
Well, that is a wealth of experience in both direct and administrative and legislative activities. So tell us what the Healthcare Advocates Office does, basically.
Yeah, so again, we're very well defined in state statute, and then through a contract with the state, a significant piece of what we do is provide individual support to Vermonters who are having some kind of problem with getting the care they need. Often those problems are, I thought I was eligible for Medicaid or Medicare, and it is much more complicated than that, or one of the many programs through the state or the Fed, and there's something wrong with my application, or there's something wrong with the way the state or somebody is understanding my income or who I am. And so we spend a lot of time helping people through the bureaucratic process of eligibility for state programs and federal programs.
So this is a service that any Vermonter can call and use if they have these kind of problems and haven't been able to get them solved.
Yeah, the only eligibility is that you're a Vermonter.
Okay.
We don't have any income eligibility. We really work with people who are here.
And I happen to know you have a very, very good staff there who also helps. So you've been looking at this healthcare. Go ahead.
I also just want to say, you know, for a lot of people, they don't know exactly what's gone wrong. I thought my insurance company was supposed to cover this. Maybe their provider did something right or didn't do something completely. We help people sort it out. Thank you for your statement, for your comment about the quality of our staff. We've got this great group of people who are on the phone right now helping people out, and we're available to help listeners out.
I think it's terrific, and I'm glad to be able to let our listeners know. But let's go talk about healthcare in general now. So you've been at this a long time, and you've seen a lot of programs come, some programs go. Is it working in Vermont, our healthcare system?
Well, I got to finish. I apologize. I got to finish. Another whole piece of my job is to represent Vermonters in front of the state regulators and the legislature and the administration around healthcare programs. So that, in answer to your question, is it working? I see it from the perspective of a consumer advocate who spends a great deal of time in meetings, in state meetings, and in front of the Green Mountain Care Board, looking at hospital budgets and currently insurance rate review and the legislative process. So that's my vantage point. Big question: is it working? It's a very hard question to answer without sort of breaking it into pieces.
Sure.
A lot of Vermonters are currently enrolled in healthcare programs and are able to get the care they need. A lot of Vermonters are also bumping into real barriers particularly affordability. When they try and follow their doctor's recommendations, they find, we hear from Vermonters all the time who are really challenged with the, you know, the costs, the out-of-pocket costs of their insurance plans, the out-of-pocket costs when they pick up their prescription meds, and their out-of-pocket costs when they, or their costs straight up when they try and, you know, get dental coverage or any number of other things. So there are real barriers that are interfering with people's ability to get the care.
While you're saying this, I should have reminded listeners earlier, but we certainly would like to hear from you at 802-244-1777 if you have any questions or concerns about healthcare affordability in Vermont. So, Mike, we hear that, yes, we do have one of the highest levels of coverage in Vermont, but we also hear that healthcare, as in education, is among the most expensive in the country. How did this happen?
Well, I think we do have to sort of look at an apples to apples. Often when insurance rates are compared between Vermont and the rest of the country, we are not looking at apples to apples because Vermont does not rate differently by age. And so we're looking at a blended rate for Vermont. But I think I want to stick to the central point of your question. Yeah, it's expensive. And it's also expensive in many other parts of the country, but it is expensive. I want to take a pause and attach myself to so much of what the great young people you had on a moment ago had to say as they sort of open up their eyes to different healthcare systems, different ways that other countries are approaching this challenge. How do we get the care that people need to them? Great set of guests that you had on first. They had a lot of important insights.
So, you know, we know that in Vermont, single-payer plan had been discussed. Peter Shumlin, former Governor Shumlin, had certainly wanted to go forward with a single-payer plan. It didn't work, didn't quite get off the drawing board. We shifted at the end of his term and in the beginning of Phil Scott's term to the something called an ACO, Accountability Care Organization. Now, we've talked about this briefly in some of our previous shows, but I suppose this is sort of a semblance of a single-payer plan, but can you explain it, and do you have any concerns about where we are?
Yeah, I wouldn't equate it in the slightest bit with a financing plan. I mean, a single-payer plan, a taxpayer finance plan is a way to assure coverage for Vermonters, for a population. The all-payer model is a very different vehicle and with very different goals. And, I do have some criticisms of it and its application, but we shouldn't confuse it with a financing plan. It's not.
So what are its major goals?
For the uninsured person or for the person who can't afford their co-pays, OneCare doesn't ascribe to do anything for them. That's part of my criticism with the effort. But we also shouldn't criticize them for not doing anything about that. That's not what they're set up to do.
Is it one of its goals, though, is to help control the costs? Where are we in terms of cost control at this point, almost 5 years in?
Yeah, I think it has been promoted by its promoters as a way to slow or fix the rate of growth in healthcare spending, I would have some real. I'm not sure that it's doing so, and it might be hard to judge. You know, again, the supporters would say, oh, it's going to take much more time to have to see the financial impacts. It sort of operates with this theory, and it's an interesting theory, that if we pay providers in a different way, that it makes them financially responsible for some of the decisions they make. They won't be just lining people up to get knees or get procedures that they that the hospital may need in order to balance its books, but that may not be in the interest of the patient. So it's an interesting theory. It is attempting to be a test to see if it will work out. And, you know, as you led into this story, healthcare is very expensive. It continues to rise at a unsustainable clip. And so some people will jump to the conclusion that, you know, OneCare is not delivering on the promise to slow the rate of growth. You know, for me, while I'm very critical of many aspects of it, it's really hard to tell at this point.
Now, we have another body, which you mentioned and you've testified, I'm sure, many times in front of the Green Mountain Care Board. It's somewhat unique for the United States as a regulatory healthcare board. Is it helping? Is it working? Is it control? Is the Green Mountain Care Board helping protect us against these spiraling costs?
You know, the Green Mountain Care Board, you know, the idea was that if we make one entity responsible for both sides, for multiple sides of the equation, not only do they have to accept a hospital commercial rate, but they also have to accept an insurance company premium. And the two are directly linked to each other. And so that the board would be able to sort of have a broader perspective of all the multiple pressures and be able to put downward pressure. Hey, I'm an advocate for affordability. And I would be the first one to jump up and down and say, you know, costs are growing too fast. And if you read my comments to the Green Mountain Care Board, my staff's comments over the years, we are always consistently saying that the affordability challenges that Vermonters face are pricing them out of the ability to get the care they need. And so, of course, I'm critical that costs are growing too fast.
There was nearly 20 years ago, we had Kaiser was here in Vermont, and I think you were probably in the legislature at that time. Kaiser, of course, is a big national HMO, which serves soup to nuts, takes care of patients, all of their needs within their system. Kaiser left the state, I think, in the early 2000s. Many parts of the country, people are very happy with the care they get at Kaiser, and they find that they're not getting surprise billings and et cetera, et cetera. Would it be helpful to have an organization like Kaiser back in Vermont?
I'm not sure. I don't recall Kaiser being in the state. I remember I think what you're describing is what I would have called the Golden Rule Plan. That this is actually previous to my legislative. This is during the Dean years where they were really very much pushed out. But let me get to the essence of your question. There's often this question of, you know, do we have enough competition in the insurance marketplace? You're right. We only have a few. We have Blue Cross. We only have a few major players. We have quite a few players who are registered to provide care, to insure lives here. But the significant ones are Blue Cross and MVP in the large group and in the individual and small group markets. And of course, Cigna, is the other major player. And then the other dynamic that's, more and more a factor here is the, number of, companies that are self-funding, self-insuring. And, that's a whole realm of insurance that is outside of state regulation. And so, we have less control over what happens there. But, you know, insurance companies can choose to come and compete in this marketplace, and they're not, which maybe tells us a little bit about whether they think they can get a foothold.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this: that we've seen, at least in recent years, a sort of revolving door. People who work in high levels of our state government leave and within a short period of time end up in the private sector, whether it's Blue Cross or with the University of Vermont Medical Center, et cetera. What are your thoughts on that? Is that a is that something we should be concerned about, or is it simply experienced people bringing their expertise to where it's needed?
Yeah, of course we should be concerned about it. It's a small state, and I want to be, you know, abundantly clear. I can't knock an individual for getting a high-paying job, and nor can I knock a large healthcare entity for attempting to hire somebody who will help them get what they want. Some of those hires were smart moves on the part of the entity that hired, and understandable on the part of the person who took the job. But it is indeed a concerning pattern. And, you know, I not too long ago started calling people in key positions and saying, hey, are you going to go work for UVM? Hmm. And everybody says, oh, no, what are you talking about? And it's just happened often enough. The original chair of the Green Mountain Care Board, Anya Ritter-Wallach, is now an employee of UVM. The next chair of the Green Mountain Care Board, Al Gobay, is now an employee of UVM. I could go on.
Yeah.
But it's sort of a common enough occurrence that it should raise concerns.
Well, let's in the time we have left, let's all three of our medical students certainly sound as if they are supportive of a single-payer plan. We've talked about in Vermont how
You know what, Dr. Myers?
Yeah.
I have to spend just a minute. I can't talk about affordability without mentioning an opportunity that people have at this moment.
Okay.
That many people might not know about. And it'll just take me a moment, but I really want people to know that the American Rescue Plan, ARPA, provided for some significant increase in subsidies for people who are buying health insurance, and in some cases for their cost sharing, for reducing their out-of-pocket costs. And so I want to make a high-level, you know, plea. Hey, if you are uninsured and maybe you went and looked at the cost of health care in the past and thought it was too expensive, go look again.
Because that's a one-time money distribution, so you should take advantage of it.
Not exactly one time. It's for 2021 and 2022. We don't know what's
years.
Happening after 2022.
Right.
But it's a significant increase.
So if people were interested, if they wanted to learn more, who would they call about that?
Well, they would first call or go to Vermont Health Connect and take a look at their webpage. And if they had any problem reaching Vermont Health Connect, they could call my office, the Healthcare Advocates Office, at 800-917-7787. And I got to give one more detail. If you received any unemployment insurance this year, any payments from unemployment this year, and you don't have employer-sponsored insurance available to you right now, the subsidies and the benefits are really significant.
Well, that is really helpful. And I thank you. And I hope people who are listening heard that and share it with your friends and family if they're in need. I think we're probably going to run out of time. I was going to ask you how you felt about single-payer plan, but I don't want to put you on the spot with less than perhaps a minute or so left. But if you want to...
I can tell you that I have worked for much of my career in favor of a much more simple financing plan that assures that people get the care they need, and again, your students that came on at the beginning of the show articulated that well.
Well, I appreciate you taking your time to come on today. Vermont Legal Aid is a very important organization. You've shared some really important information. And we'll have you back again sometime because I think you have a lot more to offer. In the meantime, I would like to invite you to come back next week, listeners. Come back next week. We're going to be talking with the Northern Vermont Poison Control Center about how to deal with accidental poisonings, and the second half of the hour with the Vermont Department of Health about summertime emergencies such as heat or insect stings, water safety, etc. Join us then. Until then, please be kind to yourselves and be kind to others.